You never want a serious crisis to go to waste. And what I mean by that, it's an opportunity to do things that you think you could not do before. This is an opportunity, what used to be long-term problems, be they in the healthcare area, energy area, education area, fiscal area, tax area, regulatory reform area, things that we had postponed for too long that were long-term are now immediate and must be dealt with. And this crisis provides the opportunity for us, as I would say, the opportunity to do things that you could not do before. The good news, I suppose, if you want to see a silver lining, is the problems are big enough that they lend themselves to ideas from both parties for the solution.
The planet has a fever.
Enough to subject millions of people to death by respiratory failure.
I'm here today to talk about a crisis unlike we've ever known, a home mortgage crisis, a crisis, personal experiences of this crisis. While this crisis is vast to escape this crisis, a housing crisis, you're likely feeling the effects of this crisis. The effects of this crisis have also for this crisis. If we allow this crisis, a crisis which is unraveling, home mortgage crisis, the financial crisis, broader economic crisis, the worst consequences of this crisis, given the magnitude of these crises, we grapple with a crisis, taking responsibility for this crisis. Help us end this crisis. Our housing crisis was born. We failed to act amidst a deepening crisis. Solving this crisis that got us into this crisis, we will overcome this crisis and once again secure that dream, not just for ourselves, but for generations to come.
I see you've got your fist out. Say your piece and get out. Yes, I get the gist of it, but it's all right. Sorry that you feel that way. The only thing there is to say. Every silver lining's got a touch of gray.
American History F, Part 7.
50 tons of mustard gas in a turkey farm.
Jesus. Problem, reaction, solution. Critical thinking question. Statism appears to be the only example of a system of ongoing attack and predation where the aggressors seem to be more fearful of the victims than the victims are of the aggressors. So how do the aggressors manage these fears? And hey, you know what? Here's another question that might be unrelated completely, but probably not. It's been over 6,000 years since human beings separated themselves from the rest of the animal kingdom, leaving a life of hunting and gathering and wandering behind for civilization. In that time, there has been tremendous advancement in science and technology and philosophy. Invention after invention, making their lives easier, their tasks more convenient, making them smarter, making them stronger, making them healthier. Vast new channels of information, leading us right up to the present day, where a person can actually access the equivalent of all of the information in all of the world's libraries, while in their underpants. So why, after all of this progress and change and advancement, do so many of these human beings still live their life in a virtually constant state of uncertainty and fear and confusion that could best be summed up as survival mode? Hello. Today's show began about a month ago when I was trying to decide how to respond to an email that I had received from a listener. It was the fifth or sixth email on this topic that I had received since beginning the show. It's from February 19th from a listener named Brian, and it reads, "Man, I love the show, but I gotta say your angle on so-called conspiracy theories has me scratching my head. Out of one side of your mouth, you talk about how we've been lied to throughout our entire lives and that we are having our rights trampled upon by an unwelcome coercive government, all the while being helped along this path by a lapdog media. Well, out of the other side of your mouth, you make snide comments about chemtrails or 9/11 truth activists. My question would be, how are the, quote, conspiracy theories you talk about, i.e. Pearl Harbor or the deliberate dumbing down of society, real and worth talking about and root-striking, while at the same time dismissing 9/11 truthers as missing the point and claim that people like Alex Jones are wacky nut jobs? Well, I agree that Alex Jones does miss the point about complete liberty since he's a minarchist. I find your dismissive attitude about the idea of conspiracies really odd. Is it because you haven't researched things like chemtrails that makes you so snarky, or have you done the research and decided it was not true? I hope it's the latter, as the former would put you in the same boat as the mind-washed masses you long to help. I hope I don't sound like a dick, because I really do think what you're doing is very important and well done, but every so often you say something that really makes me stop and say, uh-oh. I doubt, he goes on to say, I doubt you have the time to address every email that floats your way. Well, what I'm preparing here, I already know, is probably going to be the longest and most complex episode of the show I've ever done. So I definitely don't have time to do this kind of response to every email I get, but I do try to get back to everybody. So anyway, where do we start? Because this is a subject that's worth talking about and certainly fits into this series on history that we've been doing now for some time. Very quickly, I'd like to get this chemtrails thing out of the way first. There is a theory that some of the condensation trails left by jets that we see flying overhead all the time actually contains some kind of chemical mixture introduced into the aircraft fuel. And then when the trail is left by the jet, it sort of rains down slowly onto the population. And the theory behind this is that whatever this chemical compound is used for the purpose of mind control, obedience. It makes the population more apathetic and easy to manage. Well, the truth is that the government actually does have a program like this. It's called public school. And the people who benefit from that program have a pretty effective maintenance system for it called the mainstream media. It saves a bunch of money on chemicals. There's far less questions. And it's also pretty easy to demonstrate that public school is real. So I tend to approach the whole mind control, behavior management from government to population more from the school angle than the chemtrails angle, because it's far, far easier for me to establish that school exists. I can do that in under a second. And it seems like this whole chemtrails research project can take several years. The other thing, too, is when we look at the writings of the kinds of people who want to have control over society, or who want to be able to manage or use the population to their own ends, they sure do talk a lot about the importance of education towards that end, but I've never seen any mention of chemtrails. So as far as I'm concerned, this is just like a time management thing. Now, are there certain people in certain parts of the government that would do something like this? Yeah, I bet there is. I mean, there's certainly a track record for it. Look at the Tuskegee experiments. Look at what the CIA did with LSD in the 50s and the 60s, not to mention countless other experiments on soldiers and prisoners with chemicals and drugs. Yeah, I think that these are the kind of people, generally speaking, who would spray shit on other people. But I just don't think that researching it is the best use of my time. Now, as far as the whole 9/11 thing goes, why don't I start by doing this? What if I could prove pretty much beyond a reasonable doubt that the government does use false pretexts to begin or escalate foreign conflicts and wars? All in under 5 minutes of your life, without relying upon any debatable and abstruse physics evidence that people will always be able to question or dispute. And pretty much relying totally on people who were involved in the incident that became the pretext for a war. I also think that it's worth pointing out that the target audience for this short presentation is not somebody like you, who already has a healthy amount of skepticism and distrust for government. This, instead, is targeted towards the 60-something-year-old, flag-waving, America-loving, baby-booming John McCain supporter, to leave them without reasonable doubt that the government can and has used false flag operations or false pretexts to get into wars. I'll even throw in a confession. Here we go. First, here is the official story.
On the night of August 4th, 1964, President Johnson appeared on national television. He told the American people that two U.S. destroyers, the Maddox and the Turner Joy, while on patrol in the Gulf of Tonkin, had been attacked by North Vietnamese PT boats. He said neither ship had suffered any damage or any casualties. The incident, however, gave President Johnson enough cause to immediately order limited airstrikes against North Vietnam and thus escalate the war. Shortly thereafter, on August 7th, the U.S. Congress passed the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which gave President Johnson blanket approval to continue his policies in Vietnam and specifically allowed the President, as Commander-in-Chief, to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression. In essence, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution gave the President the power to make war in the absence of a congressional declaration of war.
The power to make war, to prevent further aggression. Guy actually said that. I also think it's funny that the people who get to tell the official story also really seem to like to have a lot of gun and cannon fire in the background as they tell the story. That seems perfect. So this is the Gulf of Tonkin incident that was used as the pretext for the escalation of the war in Vietnam, a war that ultimately led to the deaths of 50,000 Americans and 3 million Vietnamese. Now, for some reason, Johnson recorded most of his phone conversations. The following is an exchange that he had with the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, 3 weeks prior to the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And I apologize in advance for the audio quality.
I want you to dictate to me, I'll add a couple of pages, four-letter words and short sentences on the situation in Vietnam, the Vietnam picture. Do you think it's a mistake to explain about Vietnam and what we're faced with?
Well, I do think, Mr. President, that it'd be wise for you to say as little as possible. That's very uncertain period.
We need somebody over there that can give us a better plan than we got. But I want somebody that can lay up some plans to trap these guys and hook hell out of them, kill some of them. That's what I want to do.
I'll try and bring something back that will meet that objective. Good luck. Thank you.
In case you didn't understand what was said, Johnson tells McNamara that he wants a new plan for Vietnam to trap these guys, to kill some of them, he says. McNamara tells him that he will come up with something for him to look at, and there are no more audio recordings that I know of anyway from that conversation through the Gulf of Tonkin. But that doesn't prove anything. I mean, maybe that was about something else. Who knows? So here is the testimony of the person who was responsible for the sonar on the Maddox during the incident. This is from a 60 Minutes report in 1970.
The man in charge of the Maine gun director, August 4th, 1964, was a four-year veteran. He was also an expert sonar man. Patrick Park. Park is now a businessman in Los Angeles.
Tell me, do you think that night, August 4th, in the pitch black, in a heavy swell, rainstorms, was there anything to shoot at out there?
No, I don't. I'm certain that there was not anything to shoot at right from the beginning. The captain asked me immediately after the attack to go down and evaluate all the recordings that had been made of noise that sonar was reporting. And I kept myself pretty busy for the next 3 days, really, trying to evaluate these things and determine if we had heard anything that might have been even a question mark, that it might have been a torpedo or anything else in the water not related to the two ships or noise of either one of them.
And what was your evaluation?
Absolutely nothing.
But maybe Park is a liar. And he was certainly called that by many people at the time. Here is the recording of the radio transmissions from the Maddox. This is several different clips assembled during and after the incident.
Well, there apparently been at least 9 torpedoes in the water. All missed.
Yeah.
No, I don't... Wait a minute now. I'm not so sure about this number of engaged.
Right.
We'd have to check it out here. He said many of the reported contacts and torpedoes fired appear doubtful. Freak weather effects on radar and overeager sonarmen may have accounted for many reports.
Okay, well, I'll tell Mr. McNamara this.
That's the best I can give you, Dave. Sorry. It does appear now that a lot of these torpedo attacks were from the sonar man, you see. And they get keyed up to a thing like this. Everything they hear on the sonar is a torpedo.
And why don't we just conclude this with a statement from Robert McNamara, given in the late 1990s. McNamara, again, was the Secretary of Defense at the time of the incident. With enough around it to prevent anyone from suggesting that McNamara could be talking about something else.
There were sonar soundings, torpedoes had been detected, other indications of attack from patrol boats. We spent about 10 hours that day trying to find out what in the hell had happened. At one point, the commander of the ship said, "We're not certain of the attack." Another point, they said, "Yes, we're absolutely positive." And then finally, late in the day, Admiral Sharp said, "Yes, we're certain it happened." So I reported this to Johnson, and as a result, there were bombing attacks on targets in North Vietnam. Johnson said, "We may have to escalate. I'm not going to do it without congressional authority." And he put forward a resolution, the language of which gave complete authority to the president to take the nation to war. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution. Now, let me go back to the August 4th attack. No, it was just confusion. And events afterwards showed that our judgment that we'd been attacked that day was wrong. It didn't happen.
So what we've pretty much established here, the Gulf of Tonkin never happened. By the time everybody went to bed on August 4th, or maybe even August 5th of 1964, Johnson and McNamara knew this. And they went forward anyway with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that put more and more and more troops into Vietnam. The accounting from this decision I've already mentioned. Millions died, both American soldiers and Vietnamese civilians. Millions more died in subsequent bombing campaigns in Laos and Cambodia. These numbers, even though they are vague, do not include psychological and physical damage of the troops, people who came back injured, the countless victims and injuries suffered by the Vietnamese people. It does not count the people who were burned with napalm but lived. all of that death, destruction, despair was based on giving them the benefit of the doubt, an assumption. Now, why would I start here if somebody had asked me about 9/11? Well, all of the information that I just shared with you has been available to the public for 40 years. That the government can invent pretexts, can manufacture reasons to go to war and to sacrifice people's lives for political ends. In those past 40 years, the United States government invaded and occupied Grenada, Panama, Iraq, Somalia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Afghanistan, and Iraq again. Millions more have died. Trillions of people's dollars have been spent for these efforts. So maybe establishing that the government will do things like this is not striking enough at the root to prevent the government from doing things like this in the future. Now, we all know what happened on September 11th, 2001. And many listeners to this show might even be really too young to remember it. If I think about the student guests that I've had on the show, Paul, Jack, and Michael, they would have been between the ages of 4 and 6 when September 11th happened. How it happened? All right, well, like, am I a 9/11 conspiracy theorist? Yeah. And so are you, regardless of what you believe. The spectrum of conspiracy ranges from 19 Arab hijackers from places like Saudi Arabia and Egypt commandeered 4 commercial jetliners, flew them into their selected targets at a 75% success rate. The damage to the building caused by the jets at the two most notable targets, the Twin Towers, forced the building to basically pancake down on themselves in collapse. On one end of the spectrum, and on the other end of the spectrum, you can really take that as far as you want. All the way to aliens, reptiles, people. Now, that's extreme. Most people who think of 9/11 as a false flag operation probably look at it more as a sort of intelligence effort by some group inside the U.S. government. There are other people who tend to be more the patriot types who believe that it is some international effort to destroy America. There is a theory that even points to AIG and the insurance company Marsh & McLennan that was put forward by a man named Richard Andrew Grove. Now, what I'm saying is I'm somewhere on that spectrum, and so are you. But here's the thing. I don't care about what happened on 9/11 because it doesn't change anything for me. It doesn't change anything for me. The government is a violent organization that murders people by the millions. And I have to say, I think it's interesting that some people have decided to devote a tremendous amount of time and energy to showing that the government would kill 2,800 of their own. And the explanation is, well, you know, if we can show that this government will murder its own people, that will change everything. And if you think that, I'm sorry, your public schooling is showing. That is a nationalist idea. Why not focus on the hundreds of thousands that are dead in Iraq and Afghanistan, the millions that have been injured or displaced? Why not try to show people that instead of focusing on 2,800 people because they are Americans? Because, like, that's the thing that will wake people up, that these 2,800 Americans are somehow superior or more important than the millions who've died in other places? That is a nationalistic idea. the citizens, the so-called citizens of a government, are the people that that government preys on and threatens the most. In my estimation, those would be the easiest people for them to kill. Now, I don't want to downplay the deaths of these 2,800 people in New York and Plainsville, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C. Every murder of an innocent person is tragic. So what I really wouldn't want to do is get caught in this sort of icy cold pragmatic argument of why you should focus on this number of deaths versus that number of deaths. I really think that that misses the point. Joseph Stalin actually had a pretty good quote about this, where he said something like, one death is a tragedy. A million is just a statistic. It's funny that we're kind of taught to think like that in school, right? Everything is about numbers, and history is very distant and impersonal. So we lose the sense of value of an individual life, especially the lives of individuals in other places, especially if they have, you know, different culture or different values, and especially if those people, through our history or through our culture or through convention, can be dehumanized or associated with something like terrorism. And it always seems to happen when the government is planning an invasion of the land where those people live. That's a given. But Stalin's quote is exemplified in a very powerful way in the Steven Spielberg movie Schindler's List, in a couple of scenes. Oscar Schindler is from a hillside kind of observing the Nazis raid this Jewish village. And the entire film is in black and white, except for a couple of scenes. But this scene is in black and white, except for this one little girl in a red coat. And we see her, obviously, in the frame because she's the only character with any color in their clothing. But what it's supposed to show to us is that Schindler sees her as well. And at the time, it really doesn't seem to make that much sense until a few scenes later in the film, Schindler sees her again, and so do we, because her coat is still red. Her dead body in a wheelbarrow being wheeled to a pile of dead bodies that were being burned. And, you know, if you look at this film as a whole, there's just so much death, so much destruction, so many bodies that you can almost become desensitized to it. They just sort of blend into the background. But this series of scenes with this girl in the red coat is just a remarkably powerful couple of moments in that film. So the focus to say, well, you know, that's just 2,800 people and the government kills millions of people, misses the point. Similar to how 9/11, focusing on 9/11, misses the point as far as stopping the predation and expansion of the state. But by establishing that 9/11 was an inside job, you could also show that the government is deceptive and dishonest. So, you know, stop the presses right there, too. So instead of this energy directed at 9/11 was an inside job, what if all the people who were making and watching these videos, demonstrating all for this 9/11 cause, simply directed all of their efforts into asking statists questions about what they believe and why? I even have an idea how they could get that whole thing started. They could say something like, the primary principle that motivates my entire political belief system is the idea that the initiation of force is wrong. What's your primary principle? From there, you're like two or three questions away from walking away from that person as they sweep up the rubble of their entire status belief system. But if you're not asking questions, if you're making statements about Thermite and Larry Silverstein, you walk away from that person and they think you're insane. if we could explain to people the philosophy of liberty, the principle of non-aggression, this would not matter. And for people who understand these things, 9/11 already shouldn't matter on the one hand. But then let's look at most other people. Now, I'm not saying that these people are stupid or incapable of understanding these things. I'm just saying that right now they don't. And we want to take to them ironclad, bulletproof evidence, Gulf of Tonkin-style presentation to prove that 9/11 was an inside job. Don't you understand that there are still people who will not believe you, no matter what you show them? Because those people have already been supplied with conclusions, or a conclusion regarding this event, by the people that they consider to be the authorities. And people will say, oh, I don't trust the media. Oh, I don't trust politicians. But they seem to be able to absorb the message just fine. They learned how to do that somewhere, passively. They've already decided what they're comfortable with. Okay, these are people who watch the government operate every day. They can see the violence. They can see the theft and the threats. And they say, oh, that guy's got a costume on. Yeah, well, that's that guy's job. Oh, well, I checked a box next to that guy's name. That's your target audience for, like, complex physics arguments? 9/11 does not strike the root. Gulf of Tonkin, that is 40-year-old information. It changed nothing. What I want to focus on today instead is how these kinds of events, regardless of how they happen, are used.
And more importantly, why the people who make use of these events are so successful at playing basically the same trick on people over and over and over again.
After September 11th, in the week that follows, we have this. Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, talking to Tim Russert.
There was constant discussion about him hiding out in caves, and I think many times the American people have a perception that it's a little hole dug out of a side of a mountain.
Oh, no.
This is it. This is a fortress.
Yes.
A complex, multi-tiered, bedrooms and offices on the top, as you can see. Secret exits on the side and on the bottom. Cut deep to avoid thermal detection. A ventilation system to allow people to breathe and to carry on. The entrance is large enough to drive trucks and even tanks. Even computer systems and telephone systems. It's a very sophisticated operation.
Oh, you bet. This is serious business. And there's not one of those. There are many of those.
There turned out to be exactly zero of those. But Rumsfeld was very convincing because he had had at least 25 years of practice inventing terrifying scenarios about fantasy enemies. For example, here he is in 1976. Reading basically the same speech.
The Soviet Union has been busy. They've been busy in terms of their level of effort. They've been busy in terms of the actual weapons that they've been producing. They've been busy in terms of expanding production rates. They've been busy in terms of expanding their institutional capability to produce additional weapons at additional rates. They've been busy in terms of expanding their capability to increasingly improve the sophistication of those weapons. Year after year after year, they've been demonstrating that they have steadiness of purpose, that they're purposeful about what they're doing. Now, your question is, what ought one to be doing about that?
Now, even though this turned out to be entirely false because the Soviet Union was collapsing in on itself from communism, what was decided one ought to be doing about this, as Rumsfeld said, was to put a bunch of weapons and resources and money and training into the hands of a group of religious extremists, many of whom had been released from prison by Middle Eastern governments and sent to Afghanistan to fight against the Soviets. And if you accept the official story of 9/11 or something in that ballpark, you would probably have to admit it turned out to be not a good idea. But these are the people that we are taught to trust with these kinds of decisions. Rumsfeld was a political ally of a group of right-wing intellectuals called the neoconservatives. Their goal, like I already mentioned, was this Middle Eastern hegemony, complete control over the resources in that region for strategic purposes. They had been pushing for an invasion of Iraq since the mid-1990s. One neoconservative who was actually working in the Pentagon during the Bush administration was named Richard Perle. He had this to say about Iraq 5 days after 9/11.
Even if we cannot prove to the standards that we enjoy in our own civil society that they were involved, we do know, for example, that Saddam Hussein has ties to Osama bin Laden.
With the help of the media, the focus of the fear was quickly transferred from bin Laden and al-Qaeda to Saddam Hussein and Iraq. And then the real pile-on began.
Secretly and without fingerprints, he could provide one of his hidden weapons to terrorists or help them develop their own.
And we believe he has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons.
Our intelligence sources tell us that he has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes suitable for nuclear weapons production. Saddam Hussein had material sufficient to produce more than 38,000 liters of botulinum toxin, enough to subject millions of people to death by respiratory failure. Saddam Hussein had the materials to produce as much as 500
from three
Iraqi
defectors we know that Iraq
in the late 1990s had several mobile biological weapons labs.
Delay in decisions and inaction could lead to a massive and sudden
pause.
The regime is seeking a nuclear bomb. The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons.
We cannot wait for the final proof.
The smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom.
In the days and weeks that followed the 9/11 attack, the American people demanded response and reprisal for what happened in New York and Washington. This response was sold to them as a quick and simple effort, something that could be done with minimal cost in probably less than a month, with the sole purpose of going into the caves of Afghanistan, capturing bin Laden, and bringing him to justice. 10 years later, Afghanistan is still being occupied by the United States military, who, incidentally, are no longer even looking for bin Laden, who, incidentally, is no longer even associated with the 9/11 attacks, even according to the FBI. The war has spread, obviously, to Iraq, as planned, and now into northern Pakistan, and possibly in the future into Iran. Hundreds of thousands of innocent people have died. Billions and billions of dollars in property damage has been done. And this operation is costing the future taxpayers of America, people, many of whom are still too young to vote, which is how we're told we participate in government, right? It is costing them about $5,000 every second that it goes on. Now, as we reflect on this progression of events that still continues, and consequences are still arriving and will be for a long, long time, let me ask you this question. Do all of these things that have transpired in the last 10 years have more to do with the fact that 9/11 happened, or with the fact that most people, almost all people, accept the use of force as legitimate if it's done by people calling themselves government? And because of that strange phenomenon, the people calling themselves government can do basically whatever they want. Because if the latter is true, maybe that would be the best place to focus. If you have a different opinion, I'd be happy to hear it. But before I go any further, let me stop right there for a minute and ask, what if the former was true? What if 9/11 was necessary as a pretext for all of the things that the government has done in the last decade. If that is true, it kind of works to undermine my argument that the people calling themselves government can simply do whatever they want. If they needed 9/11, they can't. Or even if they needed to make use of 9/11, they cannot simply do whatever they want. And what I've come to believe is that the truth is actually a combination of the answers to both of these questions. Yes, it does seem like those calling themselves government can pretty much do whatever they want. But it also seems like some kind of catalyst is necessary to get public support for their plan going into motion. And rationalization for the actions of those in power is nothing new. This is something that has existed for centuries. Hundreds of years ago, it was simple. The people in charge said that they were acting on behalf of the will of God. God picked me to rule. If you have a problem with what I do, take it up with God. When people didn't fall for this anymore, they switched to a new God, the will of the people. And prior to the so-called Age of Reason, how could any decent person possibly object to or question someone who had taken on the magnanimous task of doing God's work on earth? And after the Enlightenment, how could anybody object to or question somebody who had taken on the noble task of doing the people's work for the common good, for the general welfare, for the will of the majority? That would be selfish. But even with a very, very quick comparison between what somebody says they want to do or intend to do while they are seeking power versus what they actually do once they have the power, this whole will of the people thing also kind of collapses. So what we've seen recently, really in the last half century, is the emergence of the idea that the primary purpose of those who hold power is to respond to crises, either to intervene in a crisis that is already in progress or to head off a crisis before it even happens, a preemptive strike on a crisis, if you will. But the rationalization for those in power is nothing new. It seems like something that has been very, very necessary for a long, long time. And this brings me back to the question that I asked at the beginning of the show. Pointed question, as the questions often are. First, statism is, as far as I can see anyway, the only ongoing system or institution of attack and predation where the aggressor seems to be, generally speaking, more afraid of the victim than the victim is of the aggressor. And if you think about it, this really makes perfect sense. The group of aggressors is like tiny compared to the group of victims, right? Like, imagine if 1 million people or 3 million people, 1% of the population of the United States, just stopped cooperating with them. Imagine what that would do. There's also another interesting phenomenon that happens in a variety of different forms of employment, where the person, the employee, over time builds a sort of resentment or negative attitude towards the quote-unquote customer. I remember, you know, having a job in teaching and this old curmudgeon-y teacher saying to me, wouldn't this job be great if it wasn't for these kids? I remember working in retail when I was very young and thinking the same thing, that this job would be awesome if it wasn't for the customers. You don't think that same kind of negative attitude about those that you supposedly serve happens to the people who work in government or in bureaucracies? You don't think that that is an extremely common attitude at the top of these organizations?
where there are very clear agendas in place. There is a direction that the people who can get into those kinds of positions of power want things to be moving in. You don't think that they have resentment and anger and frustration with the obstacles that they run into from people who are not willing to go along with what they want to do? Because they know that those people are stupid, and those people don't know what the best thing for them is. They don't know what the best thing for the whole society is. They don't understand the common good. I really think that people in power tell themselves stories like this. Now, with an attitude like that, looking at how large this group of people you're aggressing against is, don't you think that that could lead to a considerable amount of fear or apprehension, or it, at the very least, caution for how you proceed or how you interact with that massive group that you perceive as entirely irrational and dangerous? I think the people in power are very fearful of the masses. I think they always have been. I think especially since the American and French Revolution, they really have gotten a good idea of what's at stake. In the last two centuries, where the managers of society have apparently realized that they can get more out of people if they put people in this matrix of freedom, this illusion of liberty. The fact that those people are naturally curious and potentially reasonable has always been a problem for them to manage. And if the kinds of people in these positions of power have proven to be good at one thing in the last couple centuries, besides horrific violence, it would be the management of that quote-unquote threat that faces them. But if we look at what we've been talking about so far, just with this progression, foreign policy-wise, over the course of the last decade, doesn't it still seem like they can kind of do whatever they want? And now, for a moment, to go back to Brian's email from the beginning of the show, do you need to, like, spray chemicals on people to do this? Or do you just need to be in charge of how those people are educated? That being said, let's move this discussion away from conspiracies. And I'll take you inside what I do for a living. I recently finished working with a student that I had worked with for several months in a long-term project for his chemistry class. It's a research project on the topic of climate change, this buildup of gases that is trapping heat in the atmosphere and gradually causing the planet to warm up. Even though I'm not an expert on climate change, and I really don't even have much of an opinion on climate change, I've been helping this student organize this project, and it's interesting to see how teachers or curriculum designers set things up where it looks like the student is going to discover something, but the whole project is simply about the student reaching a conclusion that the teacher or curriculum designer has already predetermined. So on the surface, it looks like this study, like, is mankind affecting the environment? Oh, let's find out. But the closer you look, you see that the conclusion has already been reached, and the whole project is just about the student being led down that path, which makes this whole exercise excellent preparation for college, right? Where the professors just could not be wrong about anything, and your entire success is about parroting back what they say to you on some kind of paper. So, good for the school for helping kids get ready for higher education. And even more importantly,
as my bitter sarcasm continues, ready for real life, where conclusions will be given to them by authorities. And they will integrate those conclusions into their belief system without any kind of critical evaluation at all. So anyway, one of the things that I find interesting about this project is how much effort goes into bringing students to the predetermined conclusion. And I'll give you an example. We're looking at this chart that he had been given for the assignment. And basically what it was it showed the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere over the last decade. So the first year is 1998, the last year is 2008, and it's your typical XY graph where the X-axis is time and the Y-axis is the amount of something going up or down. So on the X-axis, we have the years 1998 through 2008. And then on the Y, we have the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere measured in parts per million. Parts per million. And when you look at the line on this chart, it goes right up at like a 45-degree angle. It's like, oh, gosh, that can't be good for the environment. Look at how steep that line on the chart is. Look at how much more carbon dioxide there is in the atmosphere now than there was in 1998. Gah, somebody help us. But when you look at the numbers on the Y-axis, you kind of see the lack of respect for people's intelligence that the person who made this chart actually has. The numbers on the Y-axis are not exactly set up how I would usually think about a Y-axis being set up. At the bottom of the Y-axis, the number is usually zero. Now, it doesn't have to be, but it usually is, right? In this case, the value at the very, very bottom of the Y-axis was 350. And at the very tippity top, it was 370 parts per F-wording million. So this super steep and alarming line is showing a change of 20 parts per million over a decade. Imagine having a million pennies and 350 of them are painted red and taking out 20 and painting them red and throwing them back in the pile and saying, look at that. And so that's man's impact on the environment over the course of a decade, an increase about 2 parts per million of carbon dioxide per year. But why is the chart drawn in this incredibly misleading way? Now, this is just one example of many. One aspect of the project is to produce a podcast with other students in the class. You know, that's fun to do a podcast, but the assignment is very interesting. As far as I'm concerned, it's not like find somebody in the class who disagrees with you and debate them for 5 minutes. It actually says find somebody in the class who agrees with you and discuss where you agree for 5 minutes. So where's the debate? Why not pick somebody in the class who doesn't agree? Why is that not even an option? But that's not the purpose of the assignment, to have a debate. Everyone in the class is supposed to agree. Now, on the surface of this, I think that the science is very simple. It's often called the carbon cycle. The carbon dioxide goes out into the atmosphere in three ways. The oceans release a tremendous amount of carbon dioxide. Activities on land from, you know, animals release a tremendous amount of carbon dioxide. And people also emit carbon dioxide. It is dwarfed by what is released by natural processes both on land and the ocean. But land and the ocean take carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere through processes like photosynthesis. So the only thing that doesn't take out what it puts in is us. And it could be argued from this information that man is having a net negative impact on the balance of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now, as far as I know, there really isn't much debate about this. But
where the debate begins, well, it doesn't begin in school at all, apparently, but where the debate in the real world begins is over what this actually means. And according to this incredibly misleading chart that I just talked about, I think we see what it means. 2 parts per million per year. Let's pretend for a minute that it's increasing by 1,000 parts per million per year. I still don't want the government to do anything about it. If you put the government in charge of keeping the planet like some kind of constant temperature or certain temperature within a certain range, which is fucking impossible anyway, I guarantee you the planet would look like Mercury or Venus within a century. So everything that this student is doing in this class is directed at reaching the conclusion that climate change is this catastrophic issue caused by man and something needs to be done about it. And the next step is so predictable. Propose legislation. What can you do to encourage people to reduce their carbon footprint, right? Like, there needs to be legislation. There needs to be government action. That's how problems get solved. So then we have this podcast that represents the synthesis of all of their climate change research. And if everything goes according to the teacher's plan, the final product will probably be something like,
"Ooh, Steve, I was just listening to everything that you had to say about mankind's impact on the environment, and I couldn't agree with you more. That's why the only thing that I think we can do to solve this problem is to have a carbon tax."
"Oh, well, thanks, Jim, but it was easy to come to that conclusion because of the information that our teacher provided."
"Wow, everybody, it's Vice President Al Gore who's come to join us in the studio."
"I agree with everything that you guys are saying."
"I'm thrilled to hear you say that, because the entire purpose of projects like this is that when we grow up, we'll agree with everything that people like you want to do."
Now, as you might expect, most students are smarter than this. And the student that I was working with, for example, took an anti-anthropogenic climate change position, citing things like solar activity and talking about the medieval warming period, that this is more of a natural phenomenon than a man-made one that requires the intervention of the government or some kind of larger international body. We are still waiting for the great. But I think it's interesting to point out that what I've been describing to you for the last 10 or 15 minutes represents a tiny little fraction of the government school experience. What I just talked about was the happenings in one class out of 5 or 6 over the course of 2 months out of 108 that a person will spend in the government school. This is not what I've been talking about is not a lesson of government school. He's in 11th grade. This is the application of lessons already learned. By this time in a person's education, think about the history that we've already talked about that they have already received. Think about the treatment of young people. Think about the training in obedience at the expense of reason. Think about the training in conformity to what is popular or what is conventional at the expense of truth and individualism and self-ownership and self-respect. And think about the training in indifference at the expense of curiosity, the curiosity that can easily, so easily, lead to the discovery of the truth. Think about the roots of the government education system in America. What I've been describing so far in the show today sounds like something that conspiracy theorists talk about pretty frequently, a phenomenon called problem-reaction-solution, or as they often refer to it, the Hegelian dialectic. So I don't know why on this show we keep winding up in Germany in the
first half of the 1800s, but here we are again with the story of a man named George W. F. Hegel. And the truth is, I know exactly why we keep ending up in this place and time, because we talk about school on this show, and this is where our school system came from. And these are the people whose ideas infected it. Now, Hegel is a German intellectual whose main philosophical undertaking is to evaluate and explain contradictions and conflicts that he sees going on in thought and society, like knowledge versus religion. And what he wants to do is unite these contradictions through some kind of complex explanation of how progress occurs. If you read Hegel's writing, just skimming across the surface, it would seem that he's very interested in some nice-sounding things like freedom and progress. And even though conspiracy theorists cite the Hegelian dialectic as this sort of how-to guide for false flag terror operations, I don't think that that was Hegel's intention for it. Before his influence was felt in America, it made a pit stop in Russia. He was a major influence of another philosopher, a man named Karl Marx. Now, Marx, to be fair, was somewhat critical of a lot of what Hegel had to say, but seemed to go for this dialectic thing that he developed, which worked basically like this. First, you have a thesis, which is essentially one idea or one problem. Then you have an antithesis, which is a conflicting idea or counterposition or reaction. And they blend together into a synthesis that is progress, or a harmonious resolution, if you will. But I guess the interpretation that has come in the last couple centuries is that first, before you can get to this quote-unquote progress, you need to have the problem. Well, let's also take a little bit of a closer look at what Hegel's conception of progress was. Now, if you read everything that Hegel ever wrote, your first thought would be, wow, I just wasted my entire life. But you would certainly understand the potent destructiveness of bad philosophy. And Hegel didn't believe that individuals, for the most part, were capable of achieving anything worthwhile in their lives, that they were just sort of these pawns in history, completely subject to the forces that dominated their lives. He did believe in the idea of the Superman, though, this sort of individual who could come along and, because of their extraordinary wisdom or leadership skills, or maybe even just their public speaking skills, they could move the spirit of the people in a certain direction. And, you know, if you looked a lot at the people that he admired most, they were some pretty sick and demented authoritarian rulers and tyrants. Hegel believed that the progress that resulted from this thesis, antithesis, synthesis would bring about what he called the absolute, or the perfect truth. And he believed this was embodied by the state itself, the German state that he was living in. He believed that this was sort of like the pinnacle of civilization. And perhaps we can infer from that that his very idea of progress, or of what's progressive, is the expansion of this absolute, of this perfect truth, of the state. And if we look at how this problem-reaction-solution formula has been applied, that seems to make quite a bit of sense. He essentially believed that individuals were meaningless, were insignificant, that they only had any value in what they could contribute to the political community that they lived in. This, of course, we've defined before as collectivism. The aggregate of these individuals who are all serving this higher power was his idea of the state. The state is the divine idea as it exists on earth, he said. The state is the reality of the moral idea, the moral spirit, the manifest will, self-evident, which thinks and knows itself. My friends, that is batshit insanity. But if you look at the society that we live in, the way that the government has applied this formula in our lives, in our parents' lives, in our grandparents' lives, over and over and over again, it seems like this idea caught on. And if you're the kind of person that uses this formula, or you are part of a group of people that benefits from the application of this formula, you would have to realize that a naturally curious, a naturally intelligent and inquisitive human being would not fall for the same thing over and over again for their entire life. So I think it goes without saying that some kind of training is necessary to make this formula work over and over again. And the lessons that we learn in this Prussian education system that is forced upon all of us, the lessons that we learn as children become the shackles and the manacles that we wear as adults. Providing a perfect companion for this formula that I have been describing. Everything that the state does is made possible by obedience. We all receive 12 years, in America anyway, we receive 12 years of this obedience training. The things that the state can do are not made possible by chemicals or false flag operations. They are made possible by school, by government school. Now, why don't we try out an example of how this training shows up in the real world? That does not involve the use of chemicals or false flag terror operations. The Obama administration takes office January 2009. It is well known that healthcare is a major part of their agenda. It is suspected, and rightfully so, that they are looking to set out down an incremental path to a socialized one-payer universal healthcare system. They are met with a tremendous amount of resistance. People do not buy into the idea that 1/7 of the population of the country not having healthcare constitutes a healthcare crisis, even though that was something that they tried to sell. The debate heats up, but suddenly the attention of most people is diverted from the specific details of the proposed healthcare legislation. It is refocused on a killer, a mysterious killer who is targeting our children.
More than 20,000 Detroit school children won't be seeing each other for 2 days. Officials closed all 24 schools in one district west of the city today after a high school girl came down with an apparent flu case. That makes more than 470 schools closed in at least 18 states, stranding some 270,000 children at home.
Our current guidance for school dismissals suggests that if there's a case identified in a school population, the authorities consider dismissing the students for a period of up to 2 weeks.
In Cibolo, Texas, where schools were closed last week, officials opted to keep them shut.
We want them to stay home. And when we mean home, we don't mean just not school. We mean home, home.
Medical anthropologist Ron Barrett says officials are right to err on the side of prudence.
There was a large study done at the University of Michigan that showed that in 43 cities in the United States, that school closures seem to be significantly associated with lesser mortality for that flu in 1918.
To calm nerves, President Obama's health officials blitzed the Sunday talk shows this morning, striking a carefully balanced tone.
The early news seems to be cautiously optimistic about where we are right now. We certainly can't get complacent.
And that's because much remains unknown about this virus, including why it seems to be attacking an unusual age demographic with a median age of 17.
Our leader responds.
We are closely monitoring the emerging cases of swine flu in the United States. This is obviously a cause for concern and requires a heightened state of alert. But it's not a cause for alarm. Department of Health and Human Services has declared a public health emergency as a precautionary tool to ensure that we have the resources we need at our disposal to respond quickly and effectively. I'm getting regular updates on the situation from the responsible agencies and the Department of Health and Human Services, as well as the Centers for Disease Control, will be offering regular updates to the American people. Secretary Napolitano will be offering regular updates to the American people as well, so that they know what steps are being taken and what steps they may need to take.
Takes the opportunity to plant a solution into the minds of confused and fearful people.
But one thing is clear. Our capacity to deal with a public health challenge of this sort rests heavily on the work of our scientific and medical community. And this is one more example of why we can't allow our nation to fall behind.
When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad world.
The media, as always, encourages us to join them at the feet of the state in awe and appreciation for their efforts to deal with the crisis.
Local, state, and federal officials are scrambling to stay ahead of this virus, and ground zero in that effort is the command center of the Department of Health and Human Services. CBS News correspondent Nancy Cordes joins us live from there with the latest. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Maggie. Here in the Operations Center, they are working 24/7 to gather the latest information on this case. They're putting together briefing books every morning for the secretary with the latest developments, and they're also tracking exactly where these cases are popping up, both here in the U.S. and internationally. This morning, they're telling us that 350 schools are now shut down in 17 states.
The government is purchasing 13 million additional courses of Tamiflu and Relenza to replace the millions of courses of the antiviral flu medications it has distributed to the states. It's also sending 400,000 courses to Mexico to assist.
According to the latest figures here at the command center, there are now 91 confirmed cases of H1N1 virus in 11 states, but they say those numbers are changing all the time.
Sit and listen. Went to school and I was very nervous. No one knew me. Hello, teacher, tell me what's my lesson.
As the panic ensues and the pleas for action grow louder, the government response accelerates. In Massachusetts, for example, we see them making use of the only tool they've ever had.
Also in Massachusetts, the legislature is acting rapidly on a bill updating what the state can do in a public health emergency. That bill has languished on Beacon Hill for some time, but with the flu outbreak, it's now racing through the legislature. NECN's Josh Brugadier is at the State House in Boston tonight. Josh?
RD, the state Senate passed this bill, Bill 2028, today. They did so unanimously, and it gives the governor and the health commissioner the power to act in the public's interest in case in any kind of medical emergency.
Timing sped up a hearing and ultimately unanimous Senate approval of the Pandemic and Disaster Preparation and Response Bill in Massachusetts. The bill gives the public health commissioner the discretion to respond to an outbreak like the kind going on in Mexico, to close or evacuate buildings, enter private property, isolate or quarantine people, and to get and distribute meds and vaccines. A registry of Massachusetts volunteers would be created and would be activated in case of emergency. Plus, the commissioner could request personnel from other states. The bill also protects health care workers from liability. Concerns about the spread of swine flu meant lawmakers, such as Worcester County Democrat Richard Moore, didn't want to take any chances.
It's too bad that we have to have something like that pending to get us to finally act, but this was actually on the calendar before that became a news story. So it's not that it's totally that, but it does give us another reason why it's a good idea to have this on the books.
And RD, the bill has actually passed the Senate a couple times the past few years, but has never passed both the Senate and the House. The House is expected to take up the bill sometime this week.
Josh, any penalty if you don't follow the emergency declaration rules?
It can actually get to be a pretty severe penalty, because for each day someone didn't follow a rule, for example, if somebody was asked to be quarantined and they decided not to follow that, it could be a fine of up to $1,000 per day they didn't follow, and also up to 30 days in prison.
Josh Brugadier on Beacon Hill tonight.
As I speak to you today, we have now all had the first steps of this new health care agenda imposed on us. But what none of us have is swine flu.
Test results are pending, but officials believe she has the H1N1 virus.
Now, did swine flu panic bring about healthcare reform? No. People didn't go for it. I think the reason being that there's just too many alternative voices. There's too many alternative sources of information right now that people saw through this as a kind of fear-mongering. But I think it's interesting that we definitely see the attempt to use fear, to use crisis, to use panic, to use the perception of a problem to bring about a solution. I think it's fascinating and horrifying what the Massachusetts congressman said. Oh, we've been waiting to do this forever, but now we have this panic and we can push this thing right through. That's how it works. But again, on the whole, the nation did not go for the swine flu thing. A lot of people did. A lot of people will always fall for this. But I think that the fear campaign used to bring about healthcare reform was far, far less successful than the fear campaign that was used to bring about things like the Patriot Act and the war in Iraq just 10 years ago. And that's very, very promising as far as I'm concerned. But good thing for people like Obama that at the end of the day, they can pretty much get done whatever they want. Now, I think it was like in episode 4 of School Sucks podcast when we were talking about politics, I said, it starts out with the test. The political leaders say, all right, here we are at A and we'd like to go to Z. And the people say, no, we're not going to Z. So, all right, how about instead of going from A to Z, we go from A to B. So here we are at B. What's next? Can they play that trick on people 25 more times? Now, the truth is, like I said before, we're already well halfway to a completely socialized healthcare system, which is not a good thing. If you're still in school and this is all being like pumped up by your teachers, it's not a good thing. We might talk about that in the future, but not a good thing. But ooh, you know what? That might make for a nice way to wrap up this show. You know what I think is going to happen? I think that there's going to be some kind of problem down the line with this healthcare legislation. Gosh, I don't know. People are... basically what the legislation is, first of all, is that people are going to be mandated to have health insurance by law. So the cost is going to go up. When you have to pay for something, the cost tends to go up if you don't have a choice. But people, because they don't want to pay that high price, are going to wait to get health insurance until they get sick. Even though there's going to be a fine that the government imposes on people for not having it, but because it's going to be getting more and more expensive, people would probably rather pay the fine than get it. Then what's going to happen is all of these sick people are going to be dumped into the health insurance risk pool. The other part of the law is that health insurance companies have to take people who have pre-existing conditions. So then... Oh, I can totally see like the health insurance companies going bankrupt. And I don't know, maybe a new proposal for some kind of single payer system, maybe within the next 5 or 6 years. I don't know. But in terms of this whole problem, reaction, solution thing, if the solution always turns out to be the next problem, and most people continue to fail to notice that, boy, couldn't the state just continue to expand and expand and expand forever? So thanks for listening, and thanks for noticing. And I hope you take this to school, or your parents, or your family, and you try to share some of it with them. Because I do think that there has been some progress in how this manipulation has worked in the last 10 years. And I think that that will continue to improve. A lot of people are doing a lot of really great work. We're connecting, we're sharing information, and I think this is a wonderful thing. And as I've said before, I'm very, very optimistic about the future. Now, I'm glad I could kind of end on an up note, but you know, going into all of this stuff is a pretty dark and dismal place. And I think what I'm going to do in the future is take a little bit of a break from this history series. It's not really finished. There was a couple more ideas that I wanted to explore. But I think we should do some other stuff first, some lighter, more optimistic kind of activities. So I do have some ideas for where we're going to go next. I don't feel like we need to do this all at once. It is really, it just... drowning yourself in this stuff is not good sometimes, and I really hope that you don't get, you know, overly frustrated or angry or feel hopeless about any of this. So thank you for listening. Thank you, everybody who has contributed. Thank you to Mr. Jason Osborne for his continuous support of the show. And I'd be happy to take any suggestions about things you'd like to hear covered. Send me an email. And I will see what I can do. It probably won't be something like this. But I do appreciate show prep that you can send me. And if I can use it in the show, I certainly will. Especially if it's like some school news. Oh, I didn't even directly answer the 9/11 question that was asked of me in the email. So let me do that real quick, too. I definitely think that there was, people from the Middle East who wanted to do that attack for a very, very specific reason. Even if they were, you know, pawns or dupes or part of some larger intelligence operation. Especially in the Middle East, especially in the places that have been preyed upon and exploited by the West for a century, they see the U.S. government as an extremely dangerous and violent organization, right? They're not subjected to any of the fantasies that we have to deal with for 12 years through our schooling or through our media. So if you provoke an organization that is only good at violence, the response will be violence, i.e. the military. Now, that doesn't seem to make sense. Like, why would you want to get attacked where you are? Well, what you would want to do is suck them into a never-ending imperial struggle in a place where no imperial power can win a war. Oh, and incidentally, check out the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still with Keanu Reeves. It's a remake of an old sci-fi movie from, I think, the 1950s. And this alien comes to Earth, right? It's got this whole environmental message. This alien comes to Earth to save the planet from the destructive humans that are destroying it. Eventually, the decision that he has to make is to annihilate all of mankind because they can't be reasoned with. It's interesting what happens, though, in the movie. The first people that he encounters before he makes this decision are really the only people that he encounters before he makes this decision, people calling themselves government. He gets off his little craft at the beginning. The first thing that happens is one of the soldiers shoots him, and then he has to go and deal with, like, the police and people from the Defense Department and people from the State Department. And after looking at these representatives of the human race, he just says these people are entirely irrational. So eventually, yeah, the alien, like, encounters normal folks, and he decides, wow, oh, these people are capable of reason, and they're halfway decent, so maybe this species deserves another chance. But at the same time, as the government's trying to figure out how to deal with them, they're just like, what are we going to do here? This thing isn't responding properly to our violence. Oh, so what other kind of violence do we have? We got bullets? We got bigger bullets? We got sharper bullets? How about Scuds? We got Global Hawks? We got Predators? What can we do here? It's a one-trick pony. When all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Think about who America's representatives are in terms of this Middle East situation and who they have been for the last 100 years. They knew it would draw the military into Afghanistan, that that would probably spread out from there, and that would ultimately lead to the economic destruction of the United States. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of ways that you can connect the current financial situation that has developed in the last couple years to the invasion in Iraq. And if you have any questions about that, we could talk about that. That would be like a whole other show. But just remember, too, that a lot of these people who were probably involved in something like 9/11, you know, we all saw those videos right after September 11th of them in their little training camps in Afghanistan. The footage was probably from the 90s. And let's not forget that it was the CIA that was over there training those people just 20 years earlier. And we see the videos, but it's important for us to remember that the CIA, what they were doing with these people, it was probably about a little more than just, you know, like, how do you do good on the monkey bars? It's like, how do you destroy an imperial power on the cheap? How do you lure them in and keep them fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting and spending and spending and spending? Maybe there was prior knowledge. I think at this point, prior knowledge has been established that the government had a very good information that something like this was coming, whether they knew where or when, I don't know. And that's there's the fantasy, too, that the military protects you. How'd that work out? Right? $1 trillion a year to go and aggress and provoke innocent people who live around the world. Sooner or later, that's going to come home. So finally, September 11th comes. There's four hijacked aircraft in the air being flown towards these targets. So now here is our chance to see this $1 trillion a year operation that is there to protect us in action. Here's our chance to see what they can really do. And what can they do? Nothing. Couldn't stop an unarmed commercial aircraft that had been reported hijacked an hour earlier from hitting their own headquarters. And wow, considering that, maybe it was an inside job. If you are still researching it, please keep us posted. All right. Thanks for listening.